Good evening. In the news tonight, Wells Fargo's CEO apologizes to the Senate Banking Committee, but Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren wants more than an apology.
What have you actually done to hold yourself accountable? Have you resigned as CEO or chairman of Wells Fargo?
The board, I serve at
the... Have you resigned?
No, I've not.
President Barack Obama addressed the United Nations for the final time in his capacity as president, calling for nations to address the refugee crisis.
And we should all understand that ultimately our world will be more secure if we are prepared to help those in need and the nations who are carrying the largest burden with respect to accommodating these refugees.
GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump takes to the campaign trail in North Carolina to reinforce his xenophobic take on refugees. A corrections guard at Rikers pleads guilty to conspiring to cover up a beating of an inmate. And Occupy Wall Street celebrates its fifth anniversary. With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. Beginning with the man in custody over the weekend bombings in New York and New Jersey, 28-year-old Ahmad Khan Rahami has been charged with five counts of attempted murder of police officers in the shootout in Linden, New Jersey, which led to his capture. The two New Jersey police officers wounded in the shootout have been released from hospital. Rahami is being held on $5.2 million bail. Analysts expect terrorism charges to follow. Investigators found his fingerprints and DNA at the scene of the Manhattan bombing. His face was clearly captured by surveillance cameras near the spot of the blast. Federal prosecutors said they are weighing charges over the bombings. According to the New York Times, Rahami's dad called the FBI to say his son was a terrorist. This after he was arrested for stabbing his brother in 2014. The father later retracted this, saying he meant the young man was hanging out with gangs and acting like a thug. The father said, 2 years ago, I go to the FBI because my son was doing really bad, okay?
They check at almost 2 months.
Still going on, guys.
He's okay, he's good, he's not a terrorist. I said, okay. Now he say he's a terrorist. I said, okay.
The FBI opened an investigation back then and later closed it. Ahmad Khan Rahami was arrested for stabbing a person in the leg and possession of a firearm in 2014. A grand jury, though, declined to indict him despite a warning from the arresting officer that Rahami was likely a danger to himself or others. There was a notebook that authorities found on Rahami. His opinions are sympathetic in the notebook to jihadist causes. In one section, he wrote of killing unbelievers. He praised Anwar al-Awlaki, al-Qaeda's leading propagandist, who died in a drone strike in Yemen. In other news, a Rikers Island correction officer has admitted to conspiring to obstruct the investigation into the 2012 beating death of an inmate. Byron Taylor entered the plea in Manhattan federal court today. Taylor was among guards arrested last year in the death of 52-year-old Ronald Spear. Prosecutors say another guard repeatedly kicked Spear in the head. They said Taylor helped restrain Spear and then lied about his role. Taylor apologized in court. Sentencing for the 32-year-old New York City resident is set for December 20th. He agreed in the plea deal not to appeal any sentence less than 21 months in prison. At Rikers, 75% of those incarcerated are there because they can't afford bail. This Saturday, there will be a march and rally to close Rikers. Go to justleadershipusa.org for more information. In Oklahoma, there is a rally planned for this evening. It's calling for the arrest of a white police officer who fatally shot an unarmed black man, 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on Friday. Family lawyer DeMario Solomon Simmons says the video of the shooting is so disturbing that it keeps him up at night. It shows Crutcher was unarmed and made no sudden movements.
We saw that Terrence was not being belligerent. We did not see Terrence reach into the car. We did not see Terrence attacking the officers. When Terrence was shot, he was away from the officers. They were at a safe distance. When Terrence was shot, he laid on the ground, bleeding out without any assistance. It was reported that Terrence died at the hospital. That is not true. Terrence died on that street by himself in his own blood.
The Oklahoma ACLU is calling for criminal charges in the shooting. The Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation. And this weekend, people gathered at Zuccotti Park to celebrate Occupy Wall Street's fifth anniversary. WBAI Zach Murphy was there, and he filed this report.
On September 17, 2011, the Occupy Wall Street movement was born in Zuccotti Park, located in Lower Manhattan's financial district, only blocks away from Wall Street. This past Saturday, the fifth-year anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movements was celebrated by ardent activists who congregated to pay homage and continue the work that the movement spawned. Alejandrina Murphy of the OccuEvolve group was adamant that without the 2011 Occupy movement, places such as Ferguson and Baltimore would have never captured the national dialogue because people were emboldened to take to the streets to voice their frustrations.
Occupy is still alive, and the conversation is still on, it's still moving, we're still talking about what's happening after Occupy.
How this happened 5 years ago, I couldn't even tell you when you would say maybe it was peaking. And people were wondering, well, where did it all come from? I wondered the same thing, but you don't ask questions, you know, you just kind of go with it.
Vincent Avagliano from the Discovery for Justice, a criminal justice and judicial reform organization, takes issue with those who claim that the Occupy movement fizzled out and died off.
Dialogue in this country has completely shifted in terms of when you listen to, like, where we're at as far as our elections and politics. It's basically the 99% and the 1% dialogue is... If it isn't 100% commanded the debate, it certainly set the tone of a lot of it. Even to this day, with whoever's running right now, right or left, they are all mobilizing around the same issue that people are frustrated with the way things work, and that it's unfair for some, for a lot of people, and skewed, you know, for some, and that motivates people on whatever side of the fence you're on. That's something that a lot of people gather around, and there's no question that that emerged from what happened here 5 years ago.
Samumba Subukwe of the OccuEvolve group of Occupy Wall Street reflected on what Occupy turned into after its 2011 conception and 2 month occupation of Zuccotti Park.
Even in New York City, we had about 12 or 13 Occupies in this city alone, from Staten Island to the Bronx. And oftentimes, Occupy and OccuEvolve were the first, some of the first organizers and some of the first actions fighting for $15 an hour, came out of Occupy, fighting against the Specter Pike line. A lot of that came out of Occupy. Even the Bernie Sanders campaign was influenced by Occupy, not to mention Mayor de Blasio, not to mention Viverito and a lot of people in the city council. So all of these issues come out of Occupy now. And we don't have the numbers that we have, but a lot of those people have gone on to different movements and they learned, they were trained, they got their training in Occupy and learned about civil disobedience and how to fight who the real enemy is.
Subukwe feels that as successful as Occupy was at taking hold throughout the U.S., Occupy's global footprints became even greater than the mark it left on America in places such as Madrid, Barcelona, London, and Athens.
Because a lot of Occupy came, didn't even start here. Arab Spring is one that it came out of, Europe, across Europe, Barcelona, and other places. Those people are fighting struggles against austerity. They call it against austerity and against cutbacks for programs and resources for the people. So it's even larger on a bigger scale.
Subukwe says that his group, OccuEvolve, will continue their struggle to ensure that gentrification in New York City does not compromise access to affordable housing.
So going forward, we want to connect. How do we connect the housing issue with Black Lives Matter, with even the environment, with also with the wages issue? All of these issues are tied together.
Jerry Ashton of RIP Medical Debt spoke about groups such as the Rolling Jubilee that grew out of the Occupy movement and became the precursor for the group he co-founded, RIP Medical Debt.
Created RIP Medical Debt for the sole purpose as a 501c3 to go out and raise enough money to buy and abolish $1 billion worth of unpaid and unpayable medical debt.
Ashton believes that the fifth-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street not being as widely attended as the inception is not of any concern.
What made Occupy unique was that in this one space of time, in people got together and changed the dialogue, changed the conversation at that time. The banks and the government were saying, we've got to be frugal, we've got to shut down things, we've got to save our way to prosperity, we've got to cut this and cut that. And Occupy came out and said, baloney, in other words, probably less polite, that's nonsense. You bankers destroyed this country, you destroyed our economy, you got bailed out, we got sold out. And that's where things like the 1% and the 99% came into currency. So what you're talking about is people that brought to the table a questioning of authority and a questioning of the financial system that had never been done quite in that way before.
Ashton argues that Occupy was able to successfully shine a light on how the financial system in the United States plays a huge role in issues of legal, judicial, financial, political, and environmental importance.
They thought they buried us. They didn't realize we were seeds. So we have come about, we blossomed in climate moves, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Everybody that you see anti-TPP was someone influenced at one time, if not a participant, in Occupy Wall Street. You take a look at any major movement that's going on right now, whether it be Fight for 15, whether it be Black Lives Matter, you'll see people in there that I would know are occupiers. That's the kind of effect that we had.
The Occupy movement of 2011 may well be seen in today's presidential politics and political discourse. However, its most lasting impact are all the individual activists that it inspired to address causes for a better future. Zach Murphy, WBAI News, New York.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. The CEO of Wells Fargo apologized before the Senate Banking Committee today over allegations that employees opened millions of unauthorized accounts to meet aggressive sales targets. Wells Fargo's CEO, John Stumpf.
I am deeply sorry that we failed to fulfill on our responsibility to our customers, to our team members, and to the American public.
But firebrand Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren would have none of this apology or his blaming the more than 5,000 employees who were fired. She wants to see change. Here she is today at the Senate's Banking Committee hearing, questioning the Wells Fargo CEO for the record.
Senator Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stumpf, the Wells Fargo vision and values statement, which you frequently cite, says, quote, we believe in values live, not phrases memorized. If you want to find out how strong a company's ethics are, don't listen to what its people say, watch what they do. So let's do that. Since this massive years-long scam came to light, you have said repeatedly, quote, I am accountable. But what have you actually done to hold yourself accountable? Have you resigned as CEO or chairman of Wells Fargo?
The board, I serve at
the... Have you resigned?
No, I've not.
All right. Have you returned one nickel of the millions of dollars that you were paid while this scam was going on?
Well, first of all, this was by 1% of our people.
Not my question. My question, this is about responsibility. Have you returned one nickel of the millions of dollars that you were paid while this scam was going on?
The board will take care of that.
Have you returned one nickel of the money you earned while this scam was going on?
And the board will do...
I will take that as a no, then. Have you fired a single senior executive? And by that, I don't mean a regional manager or a branch manager. I'm asking about the people who actually led your community banking division or your compliance division.
We've made a change in our regional to lead our regional bank.
I just said, I'm not asking about regional managers. I'm not asking about branch managers. I'm asking if you have fired senior management, the people who actually led community banking division, who oversaw this fraud, or the compliance division that was in charge of making sure that the bank complied with the law.
Carrie Toll said...
Did you fire
any
of those people? No. Okay. So you haven't resigned. You haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings. You haven't fired a single senior executive. Instead, evidently, your definition of accountable is to push the blame to your low-level employees who don't have the money for a fancy PR firm to defend themselves. It's gutless leadership. In your time as chairman and CEO, Wells has been famous for cross-selling, which is pushing existing customers to open more accounts. Cross-selling is one of the main reasons that Wells has become the most valuable bank in the world. Wells measures cross-selling by the number of different accounts a customer has with Wells. Other big banks average fewer than 3 accounts per customer, but you set the target at 8 accounts. Every customer of Wells should have 8 accounts with the bank. And that's not because you ran the numbers and found that the average customer needed 8 banking accounts. It is because, quote, 8 rhymes with great. This was your rationale right there in your 2010 annual report. Cross-selling isn't about helping customers get what they need. If it was, you wouldn't have to squeeze your employees so hard to make it happen. No, cross-selling is all about pumping up Wells' stock price, isn't it?
No, cross-selling is shorthand for deepening relationships. We only
Let me stop you right there. You say no? No? Are the transcripts of 12 quarterly earnings calls that you participated in from 2012 to 2014, the 3 full years in which we know this scam was going on. I'd like to submit them for the record, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. These are calls where you personally made your pitch to investors and analysts about why Wells Fargo is a great investment. And in all 12 of these calls, you personally cited Wells Fargo's success at cross-selling retail accounts as one of the main reasons to buy more stock in the company. Let me read you a few quotes that you had. April 2012, quote, "We grew our retail banking cross-sell ratio to a record 5.98 products per household." A year later, April 2013, quote, "We achieved record retail banking cross-sell of 6.1 products per household." April 2014, quote, "We achieved record retail banking cross-sell of 6.17 products per household." The ratio kept going up and up, and it didn't matter whether customers used those accounts or not. And guess what? Wall Street loved it. Here is just a sample of the reports from top analysts in those years, all recommending that people buy Wells Fargo stock in part because of the strong cross-sell numbers. And I'd like to submit them for the record.
Not objections.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when investors saw good cross-sell numbers, they did while this scam was going on. That was very good for you personally, wasn't it, Mr. Stumpf? Do you know how much money, how much value your stock holdings in Wells Fargo gained while this scam was underway?
Well, first of all, it was not a scam. And cross-sell is a way of deepening relationships. When customers
through this, Mr. Stumpf. I asked you a very simple question. Do you know how much the value of your stock went up while this scam was going on?
It's all of my compensation is in our public
filing. Do you know how much it was?
It's all in the public filing.
Oh, you're right. It is all in the public records because I looked it up. While this scam was going on, you personally held an average of 6.75 million shares of Wells stock. The share price during this time period went up by about $30, which comes out to more than $200 million in gains, all for you personally, and thanks in part to those cross-sell numbers that you talked about on every one of those calls. You know, here's what really gets me about this, Mr. Stumpf. If one of your tellers took a handful of $20 bills out of the cash drawer, they'd probably be looking at criminal charges for theft. They could end up in prison. But you squeezed your employees to the breaking point So they would cheat customers, and you could drive up the value of your stock and put hundreds of millions of dollars in your own pocket. And when it all blew up, you kept your job, you kept your multi-million dollar bonuses, and you went on television to blame thousands of $12 an hour employees who were just trying to meet cross-sell quotas that made you rich. This is about accountability. You should resign. You should give back the money that you took while this scam was going on, and you should be criminally investigated by both the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission. You know, this just isn't right. A cashier who steals a handful of 20s is held accountable, but Wall Street executives who almost never hold themselves accountable, not now and not in 2008 when they crushed the worldwide economy. The only way that Wall Street will change is if executives face jail time when they preside over massive frauds. We need tough new laws to hold corporate executives personally accountable, and we need tough prosecutors who have the courage to go after people at the top. Until then, it will be business as usual. And at giant banks like Wells Fargo, that seems to mean cheating as many customers, investors, and employees as they possibly can. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren questioning Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf today at a Senate Banking Committee hearing in Washington. For the record, regulators fined the San Francisco-based company $185 million earlier this month. Some 5,300 Wells Fargo employees have been fired, but not one of those in charge yet has been dismissed. Going to international news, an attack on an aid convoy in Syria killed at least one humanitarian worker and an unknown number of civilians. It has been condemned by the UN, which has now suspended deliveries of supplies throughout the war-torn country. Daniel Johnson reports.
Jens Laacke from UN Humanitarian Coordinating Agency OCHA described his shock and disgust at Monday evening's incident in northwest Aleppo.
This very, very dark day for humanitarians in Syria, and I'd say across the world, because I think there's been a moment of shock and, frankly, disgust by this attack. We remain committed and undeterred to continue to the best of our ability to help all Syrians in need.
The joint UN-Syrian Arab Red Crescent convoy was made up of 31 trucks loaded with food, medical items and blankets for 78,000 people. It had full permission to access those in need, according to the UN. Representing the Red Cross and Red Crescent in Geneva, Benoit Carpentier expressed his horror at the attack which killed regional SARC director Omar Barakat. He said that local sources indicated that an airstrike hit the convoy as it was unloading in Urum al-Kabra late on Monday night. In the wake of the attack, the UN Human Rights Office said that it would make every effort to gather evidence so that those responsible are brought to justice. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
But then later on Tuesday, the UN rode back on its assertion that it was airstrikes which hit the convoy, this according to Reuters. The United Nations said it did not have conclusive evidence about what had happened. Russia denied its aircraft or those of its Syrian government allies were involved. It believed the convoy was not struck from the air at all, but had caught fire because of some incident on the ground. After the Russian explanation, the UN put out a revised version of an earlier statement, removing the wording of airstrikes and replaced it with references to unspecified attacks. Washington said it still believes the attacks were the result of an airstrike, which could only have been carried out by Russia or the Syrian military. The attack Monday evening brought the lasting peace efforts in Syria to the brink of collapse. President Obama gave his final speech today before the United Nations on rejecting extremism.
Until basic questions are answered about how communities coexist, the embers of extremism will continue to burn. Countless human beings will suffer, most of all in that region. But extremism will continue to be exported overseas. And the world is too small for us to simply be able to build a wall and prevent it from affecting our own societies. Because in the eyes of innocent men and women and children who, through no fault of their own, have had to flee everything that they know, everything that they love, we have to have the empathy to see ourselves. We have to imagine what it would be like for our family, for our children, if the unspeakable happened to us. And we should all understand that ultimately our world will be more secure if we are prepared to help those in need and the nations who are carrying the largest burden with respect to accommodating these refugees.
On the campaign trail, there was a social media post by Donald Trump Jr. where he compared admitting Syrian refugees to the United States to eating poison pieces of Skittles, the brightly colored fruit-flavored treats. Skittles Candy objected to the social media post today. This happened as Donald Trump was giving a xenophobic speech in North Carolina.
It's just a plain fact that our current immigration system makes no real attempt to determine the views of the people entering our country. We have no idea who they are, what they think.
To build a wall chance, Trump reiterated his promise to build a wall, that Mexico's going to pay for the wall 100%. Hillary Clinton said she will continue to speak against Trump's attacks on African Americans and immigrants and Muslims and women and people with disabilities. In other campaign news, environmentalists want to know what the presidential candidates would do to ensure a continued federal commitment to the restoration of the Great Lakes. Andrea Sears reports.
Presidential leadership has been critical to efforts to clean up the lakes that hold 95% of the nation's fresh surface water. According to Todd Ames with the Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition, since 2010, the federal Great Lakes Restoration Initiative has invested $300 million a year in projects to clean the waters, fight invasive species, and restore habitat.
We've really seen a lot of tremendous progress on some of the challenges facing the Great Lakes. We have much more work to do. There's no question that there's significant challenges that remain.
On Thursday, representatives of the Clinton and Trump campaigns are scheduled to address the 12th Annual Great Lakes Restoration Conference, now meeting in Sandusky, Ohio. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. The news was produced with Daniel Johnson, Zach Murphy, Andrea Sears, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.